Our passage for today comes from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 1, verses 9 through 13. At that time, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. Just as Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my Son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." At once the Spirit sent him out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days, being tempted by Satan. He was with the wild animals, and the angels attended him. Well, good morning. One of the, to me, the striking things about Mark's account is how abruptly Jesus enters the story. It can be a little bit hard to notice that. You know, we've got so much background information from other gospels that we understandably want to fill in by the time Jesus shows up on the scene, but we don't get that from Mark, and I think it's important for us to try to hear, as we go through this gospel, Mark tell the story as he has crafted it. And in Mark's account, when Jesus shows up, we essentially get zero background on who this is. No genealogy like we get in Matthew's Gospels, nothing about his pedigree, nothing about his birth or visitors who come to visit him after his birth. We essentially get one piece of information before Jesus walks on the scene, and that is that he is from the town of Nazareth, the village of Nazareth. And what's so significant about Nazareth is its utter insignificance. So Nazareth in those days was like Nowheresville. A town so insignificant that most people would have no idea where it was. There's no mention of it in the Old Testament. And last week, when we left off, John the Baptist, so this Elijah-like figure who is to precede the return of Yahweh, Israel's God, he has appeared in the wilderness in the Jordan, and we read that the whole Judean countryside and all the people of Jerusalem are going out to him. So in your mind, in masses of people, throngs of people, are streaming out from the south of the country, from the province of Judea, to the wilderness where John is. Meaning that these are people coming from the center of power. There are people that are, you know, urban sophisticates. And Jesus is coming from Nazareth. Nazareth is located in Galilee, which is a province to the north. And generally, the people of Judea would have looked down on Galilee, would have seen it as kind of backwoods. And so Jesus is coming kind of from the backwoods of the backwoods. I don't know if there's such a thing as that, but and notice Jesus walks in alone. So masses of people, huge crowds are streaming out to the Jordan from the south, and from Nowheresville, Galilee comes this solitary figure. So no halo around his head. There's no special aura. He doesn't seem to strike an imposing figure. The one from Nazareth quietly slips into the baptismal line with the many from Judea. They don't know who this guy is. We as the reader actually have a little bit of background, because Mark has told us that this is, from the very first line, this is the Messiah, the Son of God. Which means, like, in our minds, as Jesus steps into the muddy waters of the Jordan, we should expect him to kind of tap John on the shoulder and say, "John, thank you for all you've done. I will take it from here." That's not what happens, though, is it? It's surprising. Jesus is actually baptized by John. We would expect it to be the other way around. So already, we're kind of getting this sense that this guy, this Messiah figure, he is in some way already in solidarity with the people he's come to save. He's come and stepped into the baptismal line with them. Now notice, as far as we can tell, no one else seems to hear or even see what's happening at Jesus' baptism. And one of the things that, as a pastor, I've found very humbling is to be invited into very intimate spaces. So I'm thinking particularly the space around death. So I've been invited into spaces where I'm usually the only non-family member that's there, and you realize you are in a very sacred space. And at this moment of Jesus' baptism, it's like Mark says to us, like, "Come here for a minute. Like, I want you to see something. I want you to step into a sacred and holy space. I want you to stand on the edge and witness this intimate moment." As Jesus comes out of the water, he sees the heavens being torn open. So notice this word here. It's easy to miss. The heavens are not opening. There's not like there's like fluffy clouds are kind of gently parting to the side. The heavens are being ripped open. They're being torn apart. I kind of think of the difference between gently unbuttoning your shirt and like ripping it open like the Incredible Hulk. And this idea of the heavens being torn open, it sounds a lot like what the prophet Isaiah, a long time before, had talked about in chapter 64. The prophet says to God, "Oh, that you would tear open the heavens and come down, so that the mountains would quake with your at your presence." So the prophet here is crying out to the high and lofty God to tear open the divide between heaven and earth, and to come down to earth in awesome power of display and might. So that's kind of looking back. But looking ahead, this is really interesting. So the verb that Mark uses to talk about this is schizo, which means to tear apart, to split. And that verb is only used twice in Mark's gospel. It's used once here at the beginning of the story, and then it's used once at the end of the story. And you can think about kind of what rips at the end. At the end of the story, after Jesus dies, we read that the curtain of the temple was ripped in two. So it was kind of schizoed in two, if you could say it that way, from top to bottom. If you remember, the temple curtain was that curtain that separated the holy place in the temple from the most holy place. So essentially, it separated out God's presence from God's people. So in both those scenes, we see in Isaiah and then later on in Mark's gospel at the end, the barriers between God and people are being ripped open. You know, and when we hear heavens, I mean, understandably, we think about kind of sky clouds. And in some sense, I'm sure Jesus was looking up towards the clouds. But I think it gives us the sense, like, for example, I've been up in many airplanes. I'm sure you have too. Like, I've been up there and it doesn't seem like it's an alternate kind of world up there. But when the Bible's talking about heavens, it's less, you know, a way of talking about the space in the clouds and more of talking about God's dimension, God's space. So one way maybe to try to get your minds around that is to think about an invisible curtain being pulled back. So the heavens could be ripped open right in front of you as you sit in your living room or wherever you're listening to this. So at that moment, instead of like a couch and a table and Cheerios spilled all over the ground, all of a sudden this whole hidden reality is opened up to you. This whole dimension that you believe and trust is there, but you can't see with your eyes, and so it's all suddenly opened up to you. So at Jesus' baptism, this space between God's space and human space is being opened up. And when that happens, Jesus looks up and he sees the Spirit descending on him like a dove. So not like an eagle, not like a falcon. The Spirit descends like a dove. It's not that the Spirit is a dove. It descends like a dove. But what's up with this like dove? Like, is the Spirit really nice and gentle? Is it maybe Mennonite? We like doves. Well, we're going to see here in just a little bit, what the Spirit does to Jesus does not sound very gentle. So I don't think that's what's going on here. There's one other scene in the Bible where we see the Spirit hovering like a bird over water, and that's at the beginning of creation. So in Genesis 1, the Spirit hovers over the water at creation. And here's kind of something that's kind of interesting to think about. At the time Mark wrote this gospel, Mark would have spoke Aramaic. So at the time, like, Hebrew was not really being spoken. It was Aramaic. And so they were translating and interpreting the Hebrew scriptures into the Aramaic language, and they called these the Targums. And there was one Targum at the time, one Aramaic translation that translates Genesis 1:1 like this. "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was uninhabitable and like a wasteland. And the Spirit of God flapped his wings over the waters like a dove." So it looks like by using this reference to a dove, it seems like Mark might be trying to tie Jesus back to creation, saying that this baptism is about much, much more than just Jesus' baptism. As one scholar puts it, "The introduction of Jesus is no less momentous than the creation of the world. For in Jesus, new creation is at hand." In our series, if you're with us on the big picture of the Bible, we saw this theme that runs throughout the Bible of the question of how is God going to restore creation? So God created this good and perfect world that was very soon spoiled. It fell. Or maybe another way to think about it is it was decreated. So there was creation and there was decreation. And we can look around right now, basically any moment, but I think we think about right now, we are not in Eden, right? And we can see that outside of, we can see it if we look honestly, we can see it inside of ourselves as well. Something is broken. Something has decreated. And so the question is, how is it then recreated? How is this deeply broken world going to be restored? And Mark says, it starts with this guy. Recreation, creation, the restoration of the world, the new creation starts with this solitary guy who walks down from the hills of Nazareth. Let's keep going. You are my son whom I love. With you I am well pleased. So one of the things about Mark, Mark is a really economy of style. So we're, you know, we're just looking at a few verses here, but they are loaded, and probably nothing is more loaded than just one line, which is so pregnant with meaning. Kind of put your Bible hats on for a minute. I want to kind of look at this because it looks like there's probably three allusions to Old Testament text in this one sentence. First, the first words, you are my son. This is likely an allusion to Psalm 2, which Psalm 2 is, it celebrates the enthronement of the king to rule over God's people. So in that psalm, we read the line, you are my son, today I have become your father. So now we have the voice of God saying, this one, this son of mine, this is the one who's going to rule over my people. This is the king. And this is important because as our story moves forward, Jesus is going to start acting like a king. In fact, he's going to start acting like more than a king. He's going to start acting like God. So for example, here real soon, Jesus is going to start forgiving people's sins. And when he does that, people are going to look at him and say, who do you think you are? It would be, you know, a little bit like if I were to walk into the courtroom down in Lisbon, just as someone's about to be sentenced to jail and say, actually, it's okay. I'm here. I forgive him. Let him walk free. You know, what's going to happen at that point? Hope, at best, I get like escorted out and, you know, at worst, I'm the one that's going to have to go to court then because I don't have the authority to do that. Now, the judge has the authority. That's the only one that has the authority in that position. And so as Jesus bursts on the scene and he begins his public ministry, he's going to start doing these things that the people don't think he has authority to do, like forgive sins and challenge the Jewish establishment, things that only God has authority to do. And people are going to look at him and say, like, wait, who are you? And by what authority do you think you're doing these things? And interestingly, later on in Mark, Jesus is actually going to drive them back to his baptism. He's going to say, oh, you're asking where my authority comes? And he starts talking about baptism. It came right there in the Jordan. You know, there's a new king here. And where does credentials come from? Where does authority come from? Is it come from his pedigree? Does it come from some spectacular miracle he had done back in the hills of Nazareth? No, like it doesn't come from other people, not religious authorities, not government officials. It doesn't come from his disciples who think he's this amazing rabbi. No, Mark is really clear. Jesus' authority comes straight from God at his baptism. Okay, that's the first part, first clause. Secondly, whom I love, or as some translations put it, the beloved. I like both these translations. I think they both kind of capture something. And this sounds like it might be an allusion to the story of Abraham and Isaac. And that story, if you remember, Abraham is sent by God to go up to a mountain to sacrifice his son Isaac. And when Abraham is told that by God, God says to Abraham, take your son, your only son, whom you love. So now we have this really tender moment between a heavenly parent and a child in which the father looks at the son and says, you are my dear, dear child. Eugene Peterson in The Message says it this way, you are my son, chosen and marked by my love, pride of my life. And then the third thing we hear in that sentence that God speaks to Jesus is, with you I am well pleased. And this seems to be an allusion to the suffering servant figure in Isaiah. So in Isaiah 42, we read this, here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom I delight. So that's where that well pleased in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him and he will bring justice to the nations. I mean, the whole line there just sounds like Jesus. And if you... The suffering servant is this kind of mysterious figure that shows up in the middle part of Isaiah 40 to I think 55, that acts as kind of a stand-in for the people of Israel. So the suffering servant is said to be the lamb that's led to the slaughter and bears the sins of many. And so this allusion to the suffering servant kind of tips us off that yes, Jesus is a king, but he's a different kind of king. He's not a king who comes to reign by force, but as a suffering servant. And remember, I said this a couple weeks ago, like the big question in your mind right now as we move through this first act of Mark's gospel, chapter 1 through 8, is who is this Jesus? And just now in the first 13 verses, we've learned a lot. We've learned that he's the Messiah. He's the Son of God. He's the Messianic King that the people of Israel have been waiting for. He's now empowered by the Spirit. He's beloved by the Father. He's given authority by the Father. And there seems to be an allusion to the suffering servant. So there's this kind of idea that this is going to be going in that pathway too. But you need to remember something, like you've been let in on all this. Like Mark told you who he is, and now you've heard God's voice. But remember, like nobody else is hearing this. And I say that because as our story progresses, you're going to be like, what is wrong with these people, especially the disciples? Like, why don't they get it? What's wrong with them? Remember, you've seen all this. You were invited into this sacred, intimate moment that they didn't see at that point. Okay. So immediately after this incredible moment at Jesus' baptism, what happens? Does Jesus get like a Bible sign, like an old scroll signed by John to mark the occasion, or like a carry-in meal on the banks of the Jordan? I would love a carry-in meal, actually, speaking right now. But no, we read that at once, immediately, so one of Mark's favorite words, Jesus is sent out into the wilderness. But this word sin, it just does not do justice to what's happening here in the Greek. A better translation is the Spirit drives out Jesus, or even casts Jesus out into the wilderness. And remember, I said, don't be thinking that the Spirit is always gentle, because this is not like a gentle description of what's happening. So Jesus goes into the wilderness for 40 days. And this is kind of odd, because if you remember, like, we're already in the wilderness. So Mark is like, says now that the Spirit drives him in the wilderness. And it's like, what is going on there? But it's almost like we're just like being taken off stage. Like we're totally now off the stage of the world and in this kind of place that's off that radar. And again, like understandably, like when you find this 40 days in the wilderness, you're going to want to fill in all the details with what you know from the other Gospels, and Matthew and Luke in particular are the ones that talk about that. But let's hear it how Mark tells it. Rather than temptation, it's more of a testing. So who meets Jesus out in the wilderness? It's, of course, Satan. It's the accuser and the adversary of God. And remember, I told you that Jesus' baptism seems to be, there's kind of like a hint that this is some kind of new creation that's begun. And think about the story of Genesis. Right after the first creation, Adam and Eve meet a serpent in the garden. And later, the New Testament will identify that serpent as Satan. And when that happens, when they're tested, they fail big time. Like, they totally give in to the testing. Fast forward to another example. The Israelites have now been rescued out of slavery in Egypt, and they're in the desert. And how long does it take? It takes 40 years. Like, hint, hint. The Israelites were in the wilderness 40 years. You know, Jesus is in the wilderness 40 days. But what I want you to think about is, like, what happened in the wilderness for the Israelites? Like, at Mount Sinai, the ink on the tablets is barely dry by the time Aaron is crafting a golden calf. Like, he's breaking the first commandment. In other words, the Israelites utterly fail in the wilderness. And in fact, like, everyone's failing, like in the garden, in the desert, in the wilderness, in the promised land, outside of the promised land in exile, like everyone is failing. So now on the stage is kind of hidden from the world at large. We have the scene set for an epic battle. On one side is Jesus, empowered by the Holy Spirit, supported by the angels. And the other is Satan and maybe the wild animals. It's kind of interesting. You know, we don't know exactly what these wild, is this a good or bad? It might be that Mark was writing to an audience that had begun to experience persecution at the hands of wild animals, like from the emperor of the Roman Empire. And so it might be a way of saying that, but we're not quite sure. But we know that Satan, he's engaged in this supernatural conflict before. But this time he has to contend with a new Adam. This is a different person than the one that was in the garden. How will this one fare? Like I said, everyone else has failed. And don't think that Jesus is some kind of robot out in the wilderness. Don't think that, like, when the Bible says he was tested and tempted, I think we need to assume that that means he was tempted, right? Like if there's not a choice, it's not a temptation, meaning he was tested, he was tempted. He had a choice. What happens? We don't get a lot of details. Very few details of Mark, but a couple chapters later, and we'll get to this here. It'll take a little while to get to that in chapter 3. Jesus is casting out demons, and then he's accused by some people, religious leaders, of being possessed by Beelzebub. And one of the reasons they say, oh, yeah, you can cast out demons because you're possessed by the prince of demons. And Jesus is like, this is ridiculous. That's absurd. And he says, this is really interesting. We'll look at it more. Jesus says, Satan has been tied up. The strong man's been bound. And so now Jesus can begin to move out into the enemy's territory and begin to take it over because the strong man has been tied up. Okay. So what we learn from that is, you know, in this epic battle, this titanic battle that seems to have taken place in the desert, it becomes clear that Jesus emerges as the victor. So this lone figure from the hills of Nazareth has succeeded where everyone else has failed. The one has succeeded where the many have failed. Okay, let's stop. There's a lot there, just a few verses, but there's a lot there. But let's think about here. What does this mean for us? At Jesus' baptism, when he comes out of the water, we see the presence of the three-person God come into view. This is one of the scenes in the Bible where we see this most come together. We have the Spirit of God hovering over Jesus, empowering him. We have the Father speaking these tender and profound words of affirmation and love to the Son. And we have the obedient Son. And it's this picture of the loving community of the Trinity. It's what theologians have long described as the circle dance. So imagine your minds kind of the three persons of the Trinity circled around in a festive dance. And what they're doing is what they've been doing for eternity. They're honoring one another. They're serving one another. They're deferring to one another. And this is like the original loving community. And what this shows is at its essence, God is relationship. C.S. Lewis writes this, love is something one person has for another. If God were a single person, then before the world was made, he was not love. So what Lewis is saying is that without the community of the Trinity, God doesn't understand relationship or love. But God from eternity has been living not alone, but in this rich and glorious community. And it's beautiful to think about. It's beautiful to kind of get this brief glance at it we get here at Jesus' baptism. And what really applies to us now, which is really stunning, is that this is not a closed community. The community of God the Father and Jesus the Son and the Holy Spirit is inviting us into this dance. It's why God created us in the first place, so that community of love could be expanded out and others could move into it. The challenge for us, I think often we struggle to trust that we have a place in that dance. So, the words of the Father spoke to the Son, you are my dear, dear child, I'm delighted with you. Can we hear these words spoken to us? Do we hear these words spoken at our own baptism and after that? And let's think about this. Why do we struggle so much to hear and let those words sink in? There's probably a lot of reasons, but I want to kind of name a couple. I think for some of us, maybe the hardest words of these that's spoken are, you are my child whom I love. If we did not have an earthly parent or parents that said those words to us, or at least communicated to us through their actions those words, it naturally becomes a lot harder to then transfer that on to a heavenly parent. I mean, that's the metaphor we're given here. I mean, think about it. Like, how often when you go really deep with someone, if someone begins to open up and you begin to peel back the layers, you find that the source of a person's anger or their pain or their desperate hunger to be loved and accepted is because they never heard those words. You are beloved. You are loved. You belong to me. You know, very few holes, I think, go as deep or as hard to fill as that one. You know, and you start thinking, why would a heavenly father say to me what an earthly father or mother never said to me? And for some people, though, for some of us, perhaps the hardest words to hear are, with you, I am well pleased. You know, even if we hear them, you know, one day, maybe we feel like, yes, this was a day where I'm well pleased. God is well pleased with me. The next day, I've got to figure out how to earn that again. And so we're never secure in the affirmation of the Father. And I think one of the reasons why may be because we're steeped in a culture where I heard once somebody say it's kind of like the old Smith Barney commercial. I don't know if you remember that commercial. Smith Barney, they make money the old-fashioned way. They earn it. I think part of us wants or thinks we need to earn that daughtership or that sonship. We need to earn those words of affirmation. you know, we can earn it through our work, we can earn it through our school work, we can earn it through our business success, we can earn it through works of charity or through service or through our ministries, or, you know, in a sense, we can do something and then we can put God in our debt. We could force him to let us into that community. And in many ways, the first person has too low a view of themselves. I can never truly be good enough to be a son or daughter of the living God to enter that dance. And the second person has too high of a view. If I can perform well enough, they will have to let me into that dance. I can earn my way into the dance if I just try hard enough. And at the end of the day, both of those are really self-absorbed. So the first one is full of self-pity. The second one is full of pride. But they're both ultimately self-absorbed because they both ultimately circle back on themselves. They circle back on our identity, our worth, our work. I think one of the harder things that we profess as Christians to kind of really get our minds around, let it kind of sink down into us, is that our faith unites us to Jesus Christ. That's hard. It's a mysterious thing. In the letter to the Romans, Paul says that we are actually baptized into Jesus Christ, meaning that as we go down to the waters, there is a death. There's a death of our old self. Our old identity is buried, and the person we were before is gone. And we then unite with Jesus to us. And when we emerge from those waters, we emerge as a new person, a new creation, a son or a daughter of the living God. And that's mysterious. Like something, there's like a curtain, and we can't see what's happening on the other side of it. And it makes it hard to kind of get our minds around. Jesus, the curtain at Jesus' baptism was wide open, but we don't always experience that at ours. And so when we emerge from the waters, it's like the heavens open up and the Father looks right at us. At this point, the creator of the world is looking right at us and he sees us. Okay? But he doesn't see us as we see ourselves. He now sees us as we are in Jesus Christ. He sees us not as we see ourselves, but as we are in Jesus Christ. And he says to us, you can fill in your name. You are my dear, dear child. I am delighted with you. You are my beloved. You are marked by my love. You are the pride of my life. Because we are united with Christ, we can never have too low a view of ourselves. You were never loved by a parent. That is a heartbreaking tragedy. Honestly, it is. But if you have been adopted and beloved by God, you are adopted and beloved by the only parent that ultimately matters. You are loved by the only one who, even if you have a great parent, this is the only one that can fill that hole in your heart that you're so desperate to fill. Now, you can never have too high a view of yourself because you are part of this family. God is pleased with you, not because of what you did, but because you have been united with Christ because of what he did. To see the Father look at us and say, you are my dear, dear child. I am delighted in you. It's critical. It's critical for a lot of reasons, but here I think is the one that emerges most clearly in the text today. After Jesus is told this, he is cast out. He is thrown out into the wilderness to face off with Satan. And you can look at this one of two different ways. If that's where you start, you know, if you don't read the baptismal scene, you start here, you're like, man, God looks a little bit, or the Spirit looks like a little bit like a bully, like he's just kicking Jesus off into the wilderness. Or you start with the baptism of Jesus, and you see God grabbing Jesus on the shoulders and saying to him, what is going to come is going to be hard. It's going to test you to your very core. And at some point, you are going to feel like breaking. It's going to feel like it's too much. Later on, it's going to be worse. You are going to cry out in agony to me, and you are going to feel abandoned and utterly alone. And that is why you need to hear, you need to believe what I'm saying to you, that more than anything else, you are my son, you're beloved, and I am so pleased with you. I was wondering this week if at someone's baptism, we need to speak two promises over that person. We need to take the person by the shoulder and help them to kind of understand what's happening behind the curtain. You are a beloved child of God. With you, God is so pleased. Don't you forget that. You got to let that sink into your very core. You got to keep telling yourself until you actually believe it. And then we need to tell them what Jesus told his disciples in John's gospel. In this world, you will have trouble. Because the reality is, and it may not be right after a baptism, but as a disciple of Jesus, you will have trouble in this world. You will find yourself in the wilderness. You will find yourself tested to the core. And there's a good chance at some point you will feel abandoned. And you're going to need to circle back to those words spoken over you. Don't you forget. You are my beloved. You are a child of God. I think sometimes as a church, we have perhaps failed to do what Jesus never failed to do. Jesus promises to give anyone who will follow after him abundant life, but he makes it very clear from the beginning that to follow him is difficult and costly. It is a path that will take us through our own deserts and our own wilderness and through our own testing. And we need to stop as a church making promises that Jesus never promised. And I'll speak for myself in saying I think some of the biggest crushing disappointments and pain in my own life have come as much from the expectation that my life wasn't supposed to be this way as it was from the actual trouble and testing and pain I was experiencing. We need to tell new disciples, we need to tell ourselves, you are utterly beloved by the Father. And I can assure you, in this world, you will have trouble. And we can say that, we can say those two promises, because if you know that verse in John, you know it doesn't stop there. Jesus says to his disciples, in this world you have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. Notice what Jesus says. He doesn't say, in this world you have trouble, but take heart, because you can conquer the world. You can do it. Just try harder. No, Jesus says, take heart. I have conquered the world. I have overcome the world. The one has conquered the world. The one has overcome the world through his life and his death and his resurrection. The one does what the many could never do, where all others failed.